Chapter 61. Let you alone. Apostrophe apostrophe said Mr. Carker.
What?
I have got you, have I? Apostrophe there was no doubt of that, and tightly too.
You dog,
apostrophe said Mr. Carker, through his set jaws, I'll strangle you. Apostrophe apostrophe, Byler whimpered.
Would he though?
Oh no he wouldn't, and what was he doing of, and why didn't he strangle somebody of his own size and not him? But Byler was quelled by the extraordinary nature of his reception, and, as his head became stationary, and he looked the gentleman in the face, or rather in the teeth, and saw him snarling at him, he so far forgot his manhood as to cry. I haven't done nothing to you, sir, apostrophe said Byler, otherwise Rob, otherwise Grinder, and always Toodle.
You young scoundrel.
Apostrophe apostrophe replied Mr. Carker, slowly releasing him, and moving back a step into his favorite position.
What do you mean, by daring to come here?
Apostrophe apostrophe, I didn't mean no harm, sir, apostrophe whimpered Rob, putting one hand to his throat, and the knuckles of the other to his eyes.
I'll never come again, sir.
I only wanted work. Apostrophe, work, young cane that you are. Apostrophe, apostrophe, repeated Mr. Carker, eyeing him narrowly. Ain't you the idlest vagabond in London? Apostrophe, the impeachment, while it much affected Mr. Toodle Jr., attached to his character so justly that he could not say a word in denial. He stood looking at the gentleman, therefore, with a frightened, self-convicted, and remorseful air. As to his looking at him, it may be observed that he was fascinated by Mr. Carker, and never took his round eyes off him for an instant. Ain't you a thief? Apostrophe apostrophe said Mr. Carker, with his hands behind him in his pockets.
No, sir, apostrophe pleaded Rob.
You are. Apostrophe apostrophe said Mr. Carker.
I ain't indeed, sir, apostrophe whimpered Rob.
I never did such a thing as thief, sir, if you'll believe me. I know I've been a-going wrong, sir, ever since I took to bird-catching and walking-matching.
I'm sure a cove might think, apostrophe said Mr. Toodle Jr., with a burst of penitence,
that singing birds was innocent company, but nobody knows what harm is in them little creatures, and what they brings you down to.
Apostrophe, they seem to have brought him down to a velveteen jacket, and trousers very much the worse for wear, a particularly small red waistcoat like a gorget, an interval of blue check, and the hat before mentioned.
I ain't been home 20 times since them birds got their will of me, apostrophe said Rob, and that's 10 months.
How can I go home, when everybody's miserable to see me?
I wonder, apostrophe said Byler, blubbering outright, and smearing his eyes with his coat cuff, that I haven't been, and drowned myself over and over again.
Apostrophe, all of which, including his expression of surprise at not having achieved this last scarce performance, the boy said, just as if the teeth of Mr. Carker drew it out of him, and he had no power of concealing anything with that battery of attraction in full play.
You're a nice young gentleman.
Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Carker, shaking his head at him.
There's hemp seed sown for you, my fine fellow.
Apostrophe, I'm sure, sir, apostrophe returned the wretched Byler, blubbering again, and again having recourse to his coat cuff.
I shouldn't care, sometimes, if it was growed to.
My misfortunes all began in wagging, sir, but what could I do, except in wag?
Apostrophe, apostrophe, excepting what?
Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Carker.
Wag, sir.
Wagging from school.
Apostrophe, do you mean pretending to go there, and not going?
Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Carker.
Yes, sir, that's wagging, sir, apostrophe returned the quantum grinder, much affected.
I was chivied through the streets, sir, when I went there, and pounded when I got there.
So I wagged, and hid myself, and that began it.
Apostrophe, and you mean to tell me, apostrophe said Mr. Carker, taking him by the throat again, holding him out at arm's length, and surveying him in silence for some moments, that he want a place, do you? I should be thankful to be tried, sir, returned Tootle Jr., faintly. Mr. Carker, the manager, pushed him backward into a corner, the boy submitting quietly, hardly venturing to breathe, and never once removing his eyes from his face, and rang the bell. Tell Mr. Gills to come here. Mr. Perch was too deferential to express surprise or recognition of the figure in the corner, and Uncle Sol appeared immediately. Mr. Gills, said Carker, with a smile, sit down. How do you do? You continue to enjoy your health, I hope? Thank you, sir, returned Uncle Sol, taking out his pocketbook and handing over some notes as he spoke. Nothing ails me in body but old age. 25, sir. You are as punctual and exact, Mr. Gills, replied the smiling manager, taking a paper from one of his many drawers, and making an endorsement on it, while Uncle Sol looked over him, as one of your own chronometers. Quite right. The son and heir has not been spoken, I find by the list, sir, said Uncle Sol, with a slight addition to the usual tremor in his voice. The son and heir has not been spoken, returned Carker. There seems to have been tempestuous weather, Mr. Gills, and she has probably been driven out of her course. She is safe, I trust in heaven. Said old soul. She is safe, I trust in heaven. Assented Mr. Carker in that voiceless manner of his, which made the observant young Tootle Turnbull again. Mr. Gills, he added aloud, throwing himself back in his chair, you must miss your nephew very much? Uncle Sol, standing by him, shook his head, and heaved a deep sigh. Mr. Gills, said Carker, with his soft hand playing round his mouth, and looking up into the instrument maker's face, it would be company to you to have a young fellow in your shop just now, and it would be obliging me if you would give one house room for the present. No, to be sure, he added quickly, in anticipation of what the old man was going to say, there's not much business doing there, I know, but you can make him clean the place out, polish up the instruments. Drudge, Mr. Gills. That's the lad. Sol Gills pulled down his spectacles from his forehead to his eyes, and looked at Tootle Jr. standing upright in the corner, his head presenting the appearance, which it always did, of having been newly drawn out of a bucket of cold water, his small waistcoat rising and falling quickly in the play of his emotions, and his eyes intently fixed on Mr. Carker, without the least reference to his proposed master. Will you give him house room, Mr. Gills? Said the manager. Old Sol, without being quite enthusiastic on the subject, replied that he was glad of any opportunity, however slight, to oblige Mr. Carker, whose wish on such a point was a command, and that the wooden midshipman would consider himself happy to receive in his berth any visitor of Mr. Carker's selecting. Mr. Carker bared himself to the tops and bottoms of his gums, making the watchful Tootle Jr. tremble more and more, and acknowledged the instrument maker's politeness in his most affable manner. I'll dispose of him so then, Mr. Gills, he answered, rising and shaking the old man by the hand, until I make up my mind what to do with him and what he deserves. As I consider myself responsible for him, Mr. Gills, here he smiled a wide smile at Rob, who shook before it. I shall be glad if you'll look sharply after him and report his behavior to me. I'll ask a question or two of his parents as I ride home this afternoon, respectable people, to confirm some particulars in his own account of himself. And that done, Mr. Gills, I'll send him round to you tomorrow morning. Goodbye. His smile at parting was so full of teeth that it confused old soul and made him vaguely uncomfortable. He went home, thinking of raging seas, foundering ships, drowning men, an ancient bottle of Madeira never brought to light, and other dismal matters. Now, boy. Said Mr. Carker, putting his hand on young Toodle's shoulder, and bringing him out into the middle of the room. You have heard me? Rob said, yes, sir. Perhaps you understand, pursued his patron, that if you ever deceive, or play tricks with me, you had better have drowned yourself, indeed, once for all, before you came here. There was nothing in any branch of mental acquisition that Rob seemed to understand better than that. If you have lied to me, said Mr. Carker, in anything, never come in my way again. If not, you may let me find you waiting for me somewhere near your mother's house this afternoon. I shall leave this at 5 o'clock, and ride there on horseback. Now, give me the address. Rob repeated it slowly, as Mr. Carker wrote it down. Rob even spelt it over a second time, letter by letter, as if he thought that the omission of a dot or scratch would lead to his destruction. Mr. Carker then handed him out of the room, and Rob, keeping his round eyes fixed upon his patron to the last, vanished for the time being. Mr. Carker, the manager, did a great deal of business in the course of the day, and stowed his teeth upon a great many people. In the office, in the court, in the street, and on change, they glistened and bristled to a terrible extent. 5 o'clock arriving, and with it Mr. Carker's bay horse, they got on horseback, and went gleaming up Cheapside. As no one can easily ride fast, even if inclined to do so, through the press and throng of the city at that hour, and as Mr. Carker was not inclined, he went leisurely along, picking his way among the carts and carriages, avoiding whenever he could the wetter and more dirty places in the overwatered road, and taking infinite pains to keep himself and his steed clean. Glancing at the passers-by, while he was thus ambling on his way, he suddenly encountered the round eyes of the sleek-headed Rob intently fixed upon his face, as if they had never been taken off, while the boy himself, with a pocket handkerchief twisted up like a speckled eel and girded round his waist, made a very conspicuous demonstration of being prepared to attend upon him, at whatever pace he might think proper to go. This attention, however flattering, being one of an unusual kind, and attracting some notice from the other passengers, Mr. Carker took advantage of a clearer thoroughfare and a cleaner road, and broke into a trot. Rob immediately did the same. Mr. Carker presently tried a canter. Rob was still in attendance. Then a short gallop. It was all one to the boy. Whenever Mr. Carker turned his eyes to that side of the road, he still saw Toodle Jr. holding his course, apparently without distress, and working himself along by the elbows after the most approved manner of professional gentlemen who get over the ground for wagers. Ridiculous as this attendance was, it was a sign of an influence established over the boy, and therefore Mr. Carker, affecting not to notice it, rode away into the neighborhood of Mr. Toodle's house. On his slackening his pace here, Rob appeared before him to point out the turnings, and when he called to a man at a neighboring gateway to hold his horse, pending his visit to the buildings that had succeeded Stack's Gardens, Rob dutifully held the stirrup while the manager dismounted. Now, sir, said Mr. Carker, taking him by the shoulder, come along. The prodigal son was evidently nervous of visiting the parental abode, but Mr. Carker pushing him on before, he had nothing for it but to open the right door, and suffer himself to be walked into the midst of his brothers and sisters, mustered in overwhelming force round the family tea table. At sight of the prodigal in the grasp of a stranger, these tender relations united in a general howl, which smote upon the prodigal's breast so sharply, when he saw his mother stand up among them, pale and trembling, with the baby in her arms, that he lent his own voice to the chorus. nothing doubting now that the stranger, if not Mr. Ketch in person, was one of that company, the whole of the young family wailed the louder, while its more infant members, unable to control the transports of emotion appertaining to their time of life, threw themselves on their backs like young birds, when terrified by a hawk, and kicked violently. At length, poor Polly, making herself audible, said, with quivering lips, "Oh, Rob, my poor boy, what have you done at last?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, nothing, mother, apostrophe," cried Rob, in a piteous voice, "ask the gentleman." "Apostrophe, apostrophe, don't be alarmed, apostrophe," said Mr. Carker, "I want to do him good." Apostrophe, at this announcement, Polly, who had not cried yet, began to do so. The elder Toodles, who appeared to have been meditating a rescue, unclenched their fists. The younger Toodles clustered round their mother's gown, and peeped from under their own chubby arms at their desperado brother and his unknown friend. Everybody blessed the gentleman with the beautiful teeth, who wanted to do good. "This fellow, apostrophe," said Mr. Carker to Polly, giving him a gentle shake, "is your son, eh, ma'am?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, sir, apostrophe," sobbed Polly, with a curtsy, "yes, sir." "Apostrophe, a bad son, I am afraid?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe," said Mr. Carker. "Never a bad son to me, sir, apostrophe," returned Polly. "To whom then?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe," demanded Mr. Carker. "He has been a little wild, sir, apostrophe," returned Polly, checking the baby, who was making convulsive efforts with his arms and legs, to launch himself on Byler, through the ambient air, and has gone with wrong companions. "But I hope he has seen the misery of that, sir, and will do well again." Apostrophe, Mr. Carker looked at Polly, and the clean room, and the clean children, and the simple Toodle face, combined of father and mother, that was reflected and repeated everywhere about him, and seemed to have achieved the real purpose of his visit. "Your husband, I take it, is not at home?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe," he said. "No, sir, apostrophe," replied Polly. "He's down the line at present." Apostrophe, the prodigal Rob seemed very much relieved to hear it. Though still in the absorption of all his faculties in his patron, he hardly took his eyes from Mr. Carker's face, unless for a moment at a time to steal. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.